Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you know about food, and what is the best way to learn more? Frances Lamb is a classically trained chef turned food writer whose work has appeared in a variety of publications, including Holly Hughes' annual Best Food Writing Books, the Gone But Not Forgotten Gourmet magazine, and now in his regular columns for the online magazine Salon. Reading his work leaves you with a sense that shopping, cooking, and eating are less two chores, followed by a potentially rewarding experience, than three separate but equally fascinating opportunities for adventure. Lately, Lamb has been writing about his recent stint in baking school, about the magical properties of a really good, locally grown tomato, and about the trend among top chefs to use liquid nitrogen as a cooking tool. All that said, Lamb is also not above exploring food on the other end of the scale, from taste testing the monstrosity that is KFC's Double Down sandwich to elevating marshmallow peeps with a wave of the blowtorch. He joins us now to talk about his work. Frances, welcome to Think.
Thank you. How are you?
Good, thank you. I want to know how you decide what you're going to write about.
Oh, Lord. What am I going to write about? There isn't a set process that I have. You know, it's not formulaic in that way. Most of the time for me, it's just a matter of what's exciting. You know, what's really got my attention at that moment. And I think, as you said, shopping is in itself an exciting thing. And often that means for me, what's seasonal, what's at the market, what's exciting. You know, tomatoes are bombing right now in where I live in the Northeast. And so that's got me really excited about that. Corn is something else I'm going to be into. And you're around Easter, it's like you go around, like, well, what's Easter seasonal food? It's like, well, it's candy.
I was going to say, one thing that I really love about your writing is that it really is sort of a mix of high and low. You sort of educate without giving us the sense that you're preaching, which I think is a flaw in a lot of modern food writing. Is it something that you've thought about consciously?
Well, I think that it's one thing to be passionate about something, and it's another thing to be able to communicate your passion without sounding like you're a little bit crazy. So, in that sense, yeah. I mean, I tried to express things I'm really excited about, but at the same time, I realized that, like, hey, not everyone is going to come at it from the same angle. Not anyone has had that tomato that makes them want to punch a hole in the wall, and maybe most people are just more peaceful to deal anyway, so they're not going to do that when they have that great tomato. So, I try to, when I approach my writing, it's often in the way that I would approach how I would tell a friend about this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Is it true, by the way, that tomatoes really do deteriorate if you put them in the fridge?
Yes, absolutely. There is an enzymatic reaction that happens if the internal temperature of the tomato drops below 55 degrees Fahrenheit. it prevents it from ripening ever again, and it starts to turn the cells mealy. When you get those really gnarly, mealy tomatoes, often it's because they've been chilled.
Well, and it makes sense. That's why they're not so good at the grocery store, because even if we keep them on the counter at home, they've probably been refrigerated for days or weeks before that.
Yeah, I think I'm not a really dogmatic, have to eat locally, have to eat seasonally kind of guy. I mean, I understand all your arguments for it, and for the most part, I agree. But for me, it's often about taste, and I think that something like a tomato, or any fruit, really, where if you think about that thing on the plant, on the vine, it's ripening, it's getting sweeter, it's getting more fragrant, it's developing more flavor. That thing plucked an hour from where you live and then brought to the market, and you can eat it when it's had time to develop all that flavor on the plant, is necessarily going to be better than something that was plucked 3,000 miles from where you are, put in a truck, and kept cold so it doesn't ripen, so it doesn't rot, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's funny when we talk about, back hundreds of years ago in the spice trade, and we talk about how people used all this spice to cover up the taste of their foods because maybe they weren't very fresh. And the truth is, we're still doing that a lot today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing that we've also discovered is hey, a lot of things actually taste good. If you put good spices on meat that's not actually rotten, it's going to taste even better.
So talk about what you've been working on lately. You took a trip recently to Bristol Bay, Alaska.
Yeah.
Talk about that place.
It's an amazing place. It is, you get off the plane. Well, first of all, I think the story with going to Bristol Bay, Alaska, if you've never traveled in Alaska before, really starts in the airport. when you land in Anchorage, which is probably where most people land and be coming from, you know, other places in the U.S., and then you take your transfer flight. Because to get on the plane to Bristol Bay, I had to leave security. I had to leave the secure area. And I started talking to someone, and saying, you know, I don't want to have to do that and go back through security. You know, what's another way to get to that gate? And they just laughed and like, there's no security to get on that plane. I'm like, what? So like, no one is afraid. No one's going there. You don't have to be afraid of anything happening on that plane. It's that remote. And part of what that means is it feels almost untouched by people.
Yeah.
The vastness, the remoteness, the beauty of it is really extraordinary and really tremendous. And I was there to see the wild salmon run. Bristol Bay is home to the world's biggest wild salmon run, where 50 million fish will come through there literally in a span of 4 to 6 weeks. And most of that will happen even in like a 10-day period. So it's like you get on that water and you're just looking at this wall of fish coming right at you. It's really incredible.
What does it look like when all those fish are swimming in one direction?
You know, it's funny because when you're talking about dealing with the magic of, you know, the natural world and the wild product, it's never going to happen according to plan. So the trip was in late June, and usually that's when the salmon are really running. And sure enough, the run was a little bit late. And so we got there probably actually a day or two before they really arrived. And you can start to see some of it trickle in. And you can start to see the bears come out. Literally, bears. I mean, you would be on the river like, hey, look, there's a bear. It's crazy. And they're walking around, you know, they're looking for the salmon. A bald eagle will just kind of swoop by waiting for the salmon. So even when you're not there, when the salmon are really running and you don't have that one moment that's extraordinary, the sense of anticipation you feel among the fishermen, among the natives, the locals, and, you know, just looking around and the animals, the anticipation for that moment is so extraordinary. You get a sense of the gravity of how important that those fish are to that place.
And it's also really striking because so many of us are salmon is that thing that's behind glass in the grocery store.
Right.
We're disconnected from what we eat many times.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what was really striking to me about this, in terms of that, is, you know, the vast majority of salmon we eat is farm salmon at this point. It's farmed Atlantic salmon. It comes from Chile or Norway or Scotland or, you know, a bunch of these other salmon. And, you know, without getting too dogmatic about it, it's all signs point to that not really being the best way for us to raise our food.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one salmon farm produces something like waste in terms of, you know, the you know, whatever they're pooping and pooing right into the water. But when you concentrate that many fish in that small area, you're talking about the equivalent of a 20,000-person city.
Wow.
Just letting go right into the water without any kind of, you know, filtration or septic treatment, you know, all the stuff that we build in cities because we don't think it's a good idea to have our waste go directly into the water, happens willy-nilly around salmon farms. And then you compound that with all the other issues that it faces. The thing with Bristol Bay is it's a wild salmon run that's actually, you know, sustainability is such a buzzword, and I think it gets overused and it gets used at this point almost as much as to confuse, to clarify for people.
Mm-hmm.
But there, you know, it's an extraordinarily well-managed fishery where you have these record runs of fish, even though they're pulling in more fish and making more money out of it than ever, because they've always been really smart about, okay, saying, look, if we take all the fish out of the water, they're not coming back.
You can't shoot the goose that laid the golden egg.
Exactly.
Do they do different things with fish up there than that, things that we don't think about in, say, landlocked Dallas, maybe?
Do they do different things with them? You mean cooking-wise?
Yeah.
Well, the one thing they do very often up there that you would think about in Dallas is smoke them.
Hmm.
Very much it's very much a part of the traditional native diet there. It's an extraordinary place in so many ways, and one of them is that for many native families up there, they get 80% of their food, 80% of their calories, just from the land, from picking berries, from fishing for salmon. I couldn't believe that. I couldn't believe that in the United States in 2010, there were people that could still do that.
So they're essentially foraging. These are not farmed berries. These are things they find.
Yeah, exactly. It's all wild. You know, in the fall, and there's a rhythm. There's a really strong rhythm they have. In the summer, they fish for salmon, and they eat some of it fresh, and they put up some of it, and they smoke some of it for later, and then they have berries in the summer, and then in the fall, they, you know, they'll hunt for caribou, and they'll eat caribou, you know, so on and so forth through the course of the year.
Are they
80% of their food comes that way.
Are they smoking it over a particular kind of wood, or does that really matter?
You know, I didn't get into it that much. I believe alder, but don't quote me on it. Well, I guess I'm on the record, so I'm already getting quoted. I believe it's alder, and it you know, it's a very different thing smoking a strip of fish than you would a brisket. You know, it's not 8 to 12. Well, actually, it is many days, but it's not to tenderize. It's not to make you do it. The idea is you really want it. Basically, they're turning it almost into jerky.
Right, you're preserving it for winter, I guess.
Right, exactly.
All right, so you went to baking school not long ago, and I was interested to read, I make bread, but I don't make anything sweet because it does seem sort of intimidating, and I was happy to see that you have felt the same way, at least about bread baking.
Yeah, in fact, I've always said I'm a cook, not a baker.
Mm-hmm.
I love cooking, and part of it is because, you know, my temperament, like I'm not a super precise person, I'm not a super detail-oriented person. But I know enough to be afraid.
Yeah, well, like once you get it in the oven, there's nothing you can do to fix it if you've messed up.
Exactly. You give me a pan and some sauce in it, and I can taste it. And if it's not like burnt or whatever, you know, I can probably make it tasty. I can add this, take out that, balance it, so on and so forth. Exactly what you said, though. With bread, with a pastry, you have to do it right. You put it in the oven, and you just kind of hope. And hope is not a plan.
So is it science more than art?
Oh, that's, you know, I think that's always an eternal question. I'm not ready to say based on 4 days of baking.
Oh, it was 4 days. So who goes to baking school?
Well, you know, the particular school I just went to is, you know, was a home enthusiast kind of school.
Mm-hmm.
I went to professional culinary school, and they have, where I went, they have an almost 2-year program that's focused on baking. And, you know, again, this is 4 days. So this is really just the basics of, you know, what different doughs are and how do you knead dough and how do you check for dough to see if it's proofed correctly. And it was a great program, but it's not geared for professionals.
Is there at the CIA sort of a cultural divide between the pastry people and the cooking people who are doing entrees and things?
You know, there really is, and it's really strange. I've always meant to get to the bottom of it. It's really the weirdest thing. It's it was something like when I was there, I was at the CIA 8 years ago or something like that. Mm-hmm. And when I was there, and I believe that it's still this way today, 3/4 of the students in the, you know, the savory side were men. And it's the exact opposite in the pastry and baking side. 3/4 are women. And you know, part of it is there's this stereotype of, you know, baking is women's work and that's a home craft and, like, you know, you're a badass cook and you're going to be knives and fire and rock and roll and drugs and tattoos and, like, oh, yeah, well, you know, I'm not going to be, like, making croissants,
mm-hmm.
you know. But it was really strange to see that play out and to see, you know, and then, you know, the other thing, too, is like, you know, a lot of students, are a lot of different ages, but a lot of them are younger.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the folks I went to culinary school with were, you know, 18 coming out of high school and, you know, learning their way in the world anyway. And you run up into a lot of bad ideas when you're that age and you try to work your way through them, like, you know, sexism and misogyny.
Francis Lamb is my guest. He's senior writer at Salon.com. We're speaking this hour about adventures in food journalism. You can join us with a story or with a question by calling now, 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this fall. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour with Frances Lamb, who writes about food as a senior writer for Salon.com. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Another one of the things that you took on, either during or maybe after your time in baking school, was making bagels. And I have to tell you, I spent the early part of my childhood living in New York. I feel like I am qualified to judge a good bagel, and they are hard to come by.
It's totally true. You know, and I think the problem with bagels now is that people just think they're round bread.
Right, with a hole and yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, it's cute, and it gets the peanut butter all over my hand. Isn't that charming? Like, but there's more to it than that. There's more to it than that. You know, I think a really great bagel is going to be a little bit hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a bad thing to put a sandwich on because you bite into it and it doesn't want to give up and all your fillings go squirting around the sides. And, you know, I think the crust wants to be a little bit crisp and really chewy. And I think that, you know, they don't want to be that big. They don't want to be like big, puffy buns.
Yeah, I read somewhere that the bagels that you get in these, like, bagel stores that they have are like 400 calories before you start putting anything on them at all. They're huge.
Yeah, it's like the things the hobbits would, like, bring with them on, like, like, you know, it's like your whole day's worth of calories.
So is it the dough or is it the boiling that makes the difference?
Oh, you know, one of the things I actually learned in baking school, which was not surprising, but is that it all makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you're cooking, and I don't want to say that to intimidate people, because you can make great food and not know what you're doing, quote unquote, not know what you're doing, you know? But I think that cooking, like any pursuit, like any art or any craft, you know, the more you do it, the more you learn about it, the more you realize, holy cow, there's more to learn. You know, it's like that old saw, you know, that old cliche about like the only knowledge we have is knowing that we know nothing.
Yeah.
I felt that way when I went to culinary school, and I continue to feel that way. The more I cook, the more I learn about cooking. It's, hey, it all matters. All the details matter. And they matter when you learn to look for them. They matter if you're doing this sort of esoteric thing where you want to know what perfection is, and you keep chasing after perfection, where, you know, all of a sudden you can see the difference that boiling it for 20 seconds makes versus boiling it for 30 seconds. For most people, that's not going to make a difference, and that's fine.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and to get it perfect, it requires making the same thing a lot. So your family has to be pretty tolerant, or you have to be willing to eat it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for a couple of days.
Yeah, you know, and who knows how many bagels I'll turn out in my lifetime now that I've learned how to make a pretty good one. I've learned how to make a pretty good one. I don't know that I can keep making good ones, you know.
Yeah, well, bread is one of those things that doesn't seem to ever come out, at least for me, and I'm not a professional. It never comes out the same way twice.
Well, you know, bread is a little bit magical. You know, you're dealing with yeast. You're dealing with so many things that aren't in your control at all.
Yeah.
You're dealing with yeast. You're dealing with, you know, the temperature in your room and the humidity level in your room will affect how the bread rises. And, you know, the moisture content in that particular batch of flour will affect it. And if you're a really experienced person, you can start to learn those things and figure out how to deal with them. But, you know, for most of us, I think, hey, if you turn out a pretty decent loaf of bread at home and you like to eat it, and it probably took you all day, but it didn't feel like it took you all day, then you're doing pretty good.
What about the there's a lot of confusion for me in the flour aisle. Is all-purpose flour really all-purpose, or is that just sort of a sort of middling bit of nonsense that we should avoid?
You know, it's interesting. When you're just talking about straight-up white wheat flour, really the difference is gluten.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we hear a lot about gluten intolerance and so on, but gluten is a protein that forms in the flour when you mix it with water and start to work it, when you start to knead it.
So that's where you get those little air bubbles when you finally cook it?
Exactly. The gluten, if you think of it, it's like a web. The more you start to work your dough, you're creating all these strands that connect to one another that form a web. And so that's the web that holds the whole thing together when it starts to rise. You know, that all the gases need to fly out of it. It's what gives the bread structure and chewiness and all that good stuff. So when you talk about all-purpose flour, that's pretty much the flour that's kind of right in the middle of how much gluten there's in there. And you think about what gluten does, again, so you go to cake flour and pastry flour, well, you want those things to be really light and delicate. So those flours tend to have much less gluten. And then you want bread flour to have more of it because you want it to be stronger. All-purpose flour was basically conceived as a way for us to have again, one flour that you can use for both bread and pastry, it's probably not going to give you the best bread, probably not going to give you the best pastry, but it's going to be good enough for both. That said, you know, I think a lot of bread recipes do call for all-purpose flour, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
It changes by brand, too. King Arthur brand all-purpose flour has more gluten than, say, a Gold Medal brand all-purpose flour, which has less gluten. So it's a little hard to say. If you're going to be really super precise about it, that's one thing. But I think for most people, if the recipe calls for all-purpose flour, that's really the best thing to use.
Francis Lamb is my guest. He's a senior writer with Salon.com. We'll go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Joyce in Dallas. Hey, Joyce.
Hi. I was listening earlier. One of the things that you were talking about was heating peeps up.
Marshmallow peeps. Yes. This is
my
first outreach.
I wait for Easter just for peeps because I am such a call me a sugar fanatic, if you will. I love peeps.
And what do you do with them, Joyce?
Well, I had a lady, I was shopping one day, and my best friend always gets on to me for eating these things. They're so god-awful for me, but I love them. And so she just told me how you put them in the microwave for 5 seconds, and
they explode.
Take them out before they start burning, of course, and they are so delicious.
Did you ever...
I tried it, and oh my God, I won't eat them any other way now.
Joyce, have you ever watched them while they're in the microwave?
Yes.
They're all, describe what happens.
They expand. I mean, like, they grow. And if you put, like, four of them together, it's like, it's funny. You can tell where the heat is working first because that one will get big first and then the rest of them will.
Yeah, and Francis, you are no stranger to doing strange things with marshmallow peeps. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, first, Joseph, I want to tell you that if you're going to be microwaving the peeps, you should really play peep joust. Which is when you put a toothpick into each of the peeps and watch them when they expand, which one with the toothpick will pop the other one first. Unfortunately, there are no winners for the peeps. I mean, both peeps get empty eaten, but still, you know, you put bets on it or something.
Because after they get big, then they fall again once the heat's taken away.
Right.
Yeah.
Or they get lanced by the other one in a vicious blood sport. Peeps, you know, one day I was thinking about, I was like stuffing them in my face. And, you know, they're coated. One of the things I love about them is they're coated in that little bit of sugar.
That crunchy little
blue
sugar on the outside.
Yeah, totally. And I recall that, you know, when you make creme brulee, the idea is you sprinkle sugar on the custard and you torch it. So that what you're doing is you're melting the sugar, maybe caramelizing it some of a little bit. And the thing that's really beautiful about sugar is when it melts and it rehardens, it hardens into a hard glass,
mm-hmm.
right? That's why when you creme brulee it, you crack into it. I mean, the only thing is it's just the magic of sugar when it melts and rehardens. And so I was thinking, well, what if you actually tried to do that with a peep? And that little bit of sugar is really just kind of enough. You have to play with it a little bit because it's easy to set them on fire and it's easy to burn them and all that, but you have to play with it a little bit, get that sugar to melt a little. And once you see it look kind of glossy and kind of shiny, then you take it off the fire and just don't touch it for a few minutes and let it fully cool. And hopefully that sugar would have melted reformed into a hard, crisp glass. And it really gives the peep a whole new dimension.
Can you do this over like a gas stove, or do you need to have one of those little torches?
If you have a torch, that's great. I did it over my stove. I stuck a little skewer in it. And just kind of like roast it like you would a marshmallow, only.
Now, when you're experimenting this way, are you hoping no one walks in the door and catches you?
Yeah, I have my clothes on.
Thanks for that. You want to be careful with melted marshmallow anyway, but.
Exactly.
Francis Lamb is my guest, 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next on the phones to Doug in Dallas. Hey, Doug.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Mr. Lamb.
Hi, there.
I got hooked on bread, and I got hooked originally on bread machines, but I also make a bit of it by hand. The thing that I like so much about bread is it's like a good chef making anything for supper. You can put anything in that bread and make it what you want. I would take an herb bread that was calling for rosemary, for instance, and then I could make it into a thyme bread or an oregano bread.
for sure.
Or I've done cheese and, you know, you just name it. And the thing that I like, again, about bread is your imagination is the only thing that limits you as to what that loaf of bread turns out to be.
Absolutely. Are you a bread machine guy, Francis, or are you an oven guy?
You know, I grew up in a Chinese family, and, you know, we don't, Southern Chinese anyway, and we didn't eat that much bread at home. And I remember when bread machines were invented, suddenly we were eating bread every night. My parents were
magic.
I'm like, you get fresh hot bread out of this machine. It's like magic. It's like, oh, there are people living in the television. But I haven't used the bread machine myself. I mean, but, and, you know, like everyone, you know, everyone's got that bread machine, so now sitting in the garage because that fad kind of went away. Or like Doug said, you know, other people went the other direction and got more into making it with their hands. After doing this class, and where we mixed and kneaded everything by hand, you know, because if you have a KitchenAid or that type of machine at home or even a food processor, you can do a lot of stuff in there. But I found it so satisfying to making it all by hand. And if you're making it for the home, you're making 2, 3, 4 loaves at a time. You know, it's not that much work. It really is not that much work. And I think there's a lot to be said about putting your hands on food. I know a chef who refuses to use tongs in his kitchen because he feels like a salad should be dressed with your hands. You should always touch your food.
Yeah, that's an interesting, there is really a kind of a sensual experience to preparing food by hand.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And yet we get kind of freaked out by that now.
You know, we do. You know, it's funny because just yesterday I was in the home of a gentleman who was showing me his collection of, quote, what he called stupid kitchen utensils. And, yeah, you know, there was one that was like an egg cracker / separator where you put the egg in it and you like squeeze a handle and like it cracks the egg open and then like the yolk falls in one thing and the egg falls in. I'm like, what's wrong with cracking the egg by yourself?
It comes with its own little separator with two halves and you back and forth.
Yeah, well, you just like, yeah, or you can say, or hey, if you want to even get more into getting dirty, you actually can separate the egg by simply cracking the egg into the palm of your other hand, holding your fingers just a little bit wide and letting the egg white stroll through and keeping the yolk in your hand. Why would we need this tool that's made, you know, probably 4,000 miles away by someone who's probably not paid enough to make it in the first place? And, you know, he had probably a dozen different things for you to not have to touch garlic. You know, a garlic peeler, a garlic chopper, a garlic smasher. I'm like, look, just smash the garlic with your knife and chop it up. It takes 4 seconds.
Do you have a dumb kitchen tool that you're embarrassed that you own now? I will admit I have one of those apple corers, which first of all doesn't work at all. You're supposed to, you know, push it down on the apple, and then you have like 8 neat little slices, and it's terrible.
Yeah. You know, it's easy to be seduced by technology. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that. And you look at that, and you're like, yeah, I'd save so much time.
So how many knives do you have? Do you have like a vast collection?
I have more knives than I need. And not as many as I want, I guess. I'm not a collector.
That's very much a guy answer, I have to tell you.
Yeah, that's a real problem. It's a totally dude thing. It's like, you know, part of it is like, oh, dudes love gear.
Okay, so I have to tell you, the most dude thing that you've done lately that made me want to be a dude was the cooking with liquid nitrogen. I got so excited reading this column that I seriously started to look up where I could find it, and then I thought, I've got way too much to do to be messing with this. But talk about how you use this stuff.
Well, the thing with liquid nitrogen that's super interesting for me is, A, it provides the opportunity to do super novel things that you never thought could be done. I mean, and then going further than that in a sort of interesting way is, oh, it allows us to do things we've always done, but just do them better.
For people who forget chemistry, we should say this is an exceptionally cold substance.
Oh God! Oh yeah, it's, you know, it's something like -366 degrees, or, you know, something incredible.
Is it not dangerous?
It is dangerous. It's absolutely dangerous. No, I mean, I should say from the get-go, I think playing with it is super interesting, but you've really got to be careful. You really have to make sure you follow a number of different safety precautions. And if you're going into it without reading up on it and finding out all the things you have to do to cook, like, I really, really, really hope that you, you know, don't rely on having hands too much, because you can lose them. But that said, hey, you know, a fryer full of oil is dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, a hot roast, a hot pan coming out of the oven is dangerous. You just have to know how to handle it. You have to be conscious of yourself and have safety in mind. But the thing with liquid nitrogen that's super interesting is that, again, it's a liquid, and you can pour it on stuff, and it's so cold, it basically instantly freezes anything you pour it onto.
This is how they make those Dippin' Dots, that ice cream that you see, like, at state fairs and stuff.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, I don't know their particular process, but I think it's something like when you get an ice cream mix, and instead of taking, you know, however long to freeze it in the freezer, and then you got to freeze it in your machine, and then freeze it back in the freezer, yada, yada, you basically just, like, pour it into the liquid nitrogen, and bang, it's frozen.
So what are chefs doing with this stuff?
You know, a lot of chefs are, I think, the ones, you can sort of see, the ones who are really starting to play with it are kind of doing the most out there stuff with it, mm-hmm. the most novel things with it. The first thing I saw with it, and it's not new. I mean, like, in the 1800s, people were experimenting with it. I mean, so it's not, like, a totally brand new thing, but I think the idea of bringing it into restaurants is kind of new. And the first thing I saw with it was about 5 or 6 years ago, and a chef had taken a soda siphon and filled it with really, really nice olive oil and shot it into a container of liquid nitrogen. And what happens is the oil gets so cold instantly that it froze. And then he scooped it out with a strainer, basically, you know, with a, like a slotted spoon, basically. And he pulled out this stuff that looked exactly like popcorn. It looked exactly like popcorn. And you let it not cool down, but actually warm up so it doesn't freeze your mouth, mm-hmm. right? You taste it, and it's like, oh, my God, this popcorn tastes exactly like olive oil. Well, that's because it's what it is. And you never thought that you could freeze oil, like
wow.
solid. So there's all these opportunities for doing interesting stuff like that.
Francis Lamb is with us. He's a senior writer for Salon.com. He writes about food. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this fall. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Salon.com's senior writer, Francis Lamb. We are talking about his adventures in food journalism. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Francis, did you actually get liquid nitrogen to play with yourself, or were you sort of watching other people work with it?
I the only time I've played with it was actually in the kitchen of a restaurant who was showing me a dish that I enjoyed there and was really enthralled by.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never had to bring it home.
I think I would be tempted to run through the house gathering up armloads of other sorts of things that I'd like to see instantly frozen.
Yeah. Like laundry detergent. Yeah,
just to see what happens. Yeah, exactly.
What happens when I throw the diapers in there?
Is there anything, I mentioned at the top that you you did a review of the KFC Double Down sandwich, which strikes me as such an affront to God and nature that it just shouldn't be out there. But you were quoted somewhere saying that you will eat sort of great food, you will eat the lowest of the low, but you won't eat the mid-grade junk food. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, I feel like, well, first of all, I love food. That's why I, you know, found myself doing what I do. Well, that in a combination of extraordinary good fortune, found myself getting to write about it. And loving food for me means exactly what you said. I love the high. You know, I'm really excited by really high-level chefs and what they're doing, and I'm really excited by great, you know, local, organic, seasonal produce, yada, and all that stuff. But at the same time, it's like, look, there's pleasure to be had all over the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for me, and I kind of feel like, look, macaroni and cheese is the thing that I look at for that. If you have great macaroni and cheese made with, like, you know, great pasta and a skilled cook and really great cheese, hey, delicious, right? Or even just, like, the real thing. Like, a mom pulled it out of an oven, the real thing, love it. And then you go to the other end of the spectrum, and you have the powder, right? You're boiling it up, and you got the powder and the margarine in the bowl, and you're mixing it together. And, like, it's not, you know, it glows orange. Like, when you turn off the light, it's still glowing, staring at you. You know what? I think that's delicious, too.
I have to say, we had that about twice a week when I was growing up, so I have warm feelings toward it, even though it's probably taken 3 years off the end of my life.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and those 3 years, you know, hopefully you won't need them. So. But the stuff that really offends me is the mid-grade fake food.
Uh-huh.
Because it's like, look, that powder stuff, no one's fooled, right? You don't think that's real macaroni and cheese. It's sort of like its own thing. You know, it's like you walk into a fantasy world, and this is the food they eat in that fantasy world. But when you get to that mid-grade, and it's so they're pretending like it's real, and instead of, like, the powder, they have some packet where you open it up and it's supposed to be quote-unquote real cheese sauce and it's salty and it's like glue. Like, that is disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to fool me. I'll fool myself if I have to, but I don't want you to fool me.
What do you think about restaurant Chinese food in this country?
Oh, God.
Because I think there is, it's pretty rare to find a really amazing meal. So much of it is sort of oversalted and there's all this MSG, and I know that's not what people are really eating every day in China.
Yeah, well, you know, God, I mean, probably what they're eating every day in China is melamine, but that's another issue entirely.
Just the babies.
Yeah. Oh, God, the poor babies.
I don't mean to make a joke about that. We're going to get 10 emails, and I don't think it's funny at all, but that's the story you're referring to.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, the situation in the food system in China is really, really scary. But in terms of the cuisine, no, right? One of the things that I think is really interesting about Chinese food in America is, in some ways, it's both the best and the worst of America, mm-hmm. I think. In a lot of ways, it you know, from an eater standpoint and from someone who has had the opportunity to go to places in China and eat the food locally and taste, you know, the cuisine, you know, a lot of it isn't good. I mean, I'll be honest with you. Like, your local corner Chinese takeout place that has the same menu as the other corner takeout place, you know, a lot of it isn't very good food. Like you said, a lot of it's oversalted, or it's not made by people who are really cooking because they love cooking. But at the same time, it's kind of what's beautiful about America, because a lot of it is, you know, it's the entrepreneurial spirit, and it's the spirit of hardworking immigrants who come here and, like, this is the industry that they want to work in because... Mm-hmm. Hey, they found that it, you know, my cousin can make a living on it, and my other cousin can make a living on it. So I'm going to try to make a living on it. So in that sense, you know, I respect that, and I respect all people who work in restaurants, because it's the hardest work, or it's one of the hardest industries to make it in.
And the margins are super low, too, in most places.
The margins are tremendously. I mean, there's a reason why, you know... When you're paying $4.95 for a special, you know, General Tso's chicken with pork fried rice and a can of soda on the side, you know, they're not making a lot of money on that.
Right. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Francis Lam is my guest. We'll go next on the phones to Fred in Waxahachie. Hi, Fred.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
Good. Hey, I just wanted to kind of talk about some really cutting-edge foods. Like, I know here in Texas there's not a lot of really, really cutting-edge restaurants, but I hear there's a restaurant in Chicago called Moto, M-O-T-O. I'm just wondering if your caller has ever, I mean, if your guest has ever been there or anything to offer on that.
Do you know anything about Moto?
I'm sorry?
Do you know Moto?
I do know Moto, and I've always read really interesting things about it. I've never had the chance to go there, unfortunately. There's another restaurant in Chicago that a lot of people will group in the same category because it is very cutting edge in terms of its technology, called Alinea, where I had one of the most extraordinary meals of my life. And it's, you know, it was interesting because as a cook, you know, you look at these high-tech places, like the caller referred to, who are using super high, you know, like liquid nitrogen, like we talked about, or just other technologies, other, you know, gels and foams and all that stuff. And a lot of it is really exciting for a cook because, hey, I don't know how to make that. mm-hmm. and I want to know what they did. You know, it's kind of like a, I want to peek behind the curtain kind of thing.
Yeah.
At Alinea, I think what's really special about Alinea, what's really striking about Alinea is they use all that high-tech stuff, but it's not the first thing you notice, because they all use it in service of something else, in service of great food, in service of extraordinary flavor, in service of surprise and an element of really emotional entertainment, emotional experiences. When I ate there, the whole thing, like, how did they make this, totally fell into the back of my head. I didn't even think about it because it was just, it made me so happy to eat that food. There was at one point where I literally started giggling. It was in between courses, and I just started giggling uncontrollably. I had no idea what was going on. Like, what was going on with me? I was having some, like, emotional attack where I started giggling, and all of a sudden I was, like, at that peak where you're like, oh, he's really emotional right now. Like, I was giggling, and I don't know if at the other end of that peak I would just keep laughing or if I would start crying. And I'm being totally serious.
So it's like the corned beef sandwich in When Harry Met Sally?
Not quite the same kind of giggling.
So what did you have?
Oh, God. Well, it's the menu format there is you know, either 12 or 24 courses. So, you know, what did you have is another thing. I think I will be here all night. But I remember very distinctly one thing was so simple. It was basically a shot glass mm-hmm. with what looked like a ping pong ball in it and a little bit of green. And the instruction was, hey, just do it like a shot. Like, okay, cool. You put the glass to your lips, you do the shot. The little green, it was a celery juice.
Mm-hmm.
And so it had that nice flavor, you know, celery's nice. The ball hits your mouth, and the moment it gets in your mouth, it just shatters on its own. And inside it, there's just apple juice inside.
Wow. So what was the outside?
I'm sorry?
What was outside? What held the shape?
The shape was, I believe it was like white chocolate infused with a little bit of horseradish.
Wow.
But it wasn't very sweet. It was basically, it was there because that's a thing that they can sort of shape and do it to that thinness where it'll hold mm-hmm. in the glass. But the delicacy of it will make it shatter when it's in your mouth. And so basically what's going on in your head is, hey, I'm drinking something that tastes like celery. Oh, my God, it turned into apple. What just happened? And it's so surprising. And the apple juice is sweet and it's tart. And it's such a comforting, you know, familiar flavor. But it's presented in this totally weird way because it just totally shocked your brain. And it just makes you smile. And I remember I had a really early reservation. We started dinner at 5, and most people get, you know, some version of the same meal, the same progression.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember looking at the other people in the room, and when a table full of, you know, those celery apple shots came by, I would just, like, look at people's faces while they were eating.
Anticipating their surprise.
Yeah, and just watching their eyes just open, like, oh, my God, what just happened?
Huh. You know, what's interesting about that is that if you said, I'm going to give you the best thing you've ever tasted, here's what it's going to contain. Celery juice, apple juice, white chocolate, and horseradish. I would walk the other way.
Right.
Maybe
right?
Run the other way. What is it? I mean, how is it that we as Americans are okay with sort of entrusting our palates to a great chef in a really expensive restaurant, but we really are cautious, most of us, to try that when we're cooking dinner at home?
That's really interesting. That's a really good question. Well, I think part of it is, you know, if you're, you know, sometimes it's like, well, you know, they're the pros, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We'll let the pros do their thing. I think that there is, though, a couple of different things at play here. I think at home, when we're making food, I mean, we're making food because we need to eat.
Right.
We do it for entertainment. We do it for fun. We do it because it's, you know, cathartic or whatever. But often, you know, you're also making because, like, hey, you need to have dinner on the table. And so I think because of the necessity of that, maybe we're a little more hesitant to try, or maybe we're a little intimidated to try things we haven't tried before. But I do think one of the things that's really interesting about American food culture is how open we are to other cuisines and new inventiveness. And I think part of it is because we're a nation of immigrants And because, you know, we're just constantly exposed to our neighbors' foods that mm-hmm. may be very different from our own. I think part of it is because we're such a young country and, like, we don't have 1,000 years of culinary history that's just kind of, like, ground its way into our consciousness. We've always been seeing new stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at it that way, because instead of thinking, well, it's sort of a limitation that we've just got this hodgepodge, in fact, it's sort of liberating.
Yeah, I mean, if you ask me, hey, what's American cuisine, that's what I have to say it is. It's that hodgepodge, and it's how that hodgepodge influences itself. And it's how living in a country that reflects so much of the world comes together.
Do you think we're getting better at sort of understanding what's in what we eat? I know there's this move to sort of get away from processed foods, and people certainly do that. But there's a whole segment, it seems, of the American population that doesn't have the time or the skills or the inclination or the education to sort of get that. Are we preaching to a smaller and smaller group of people who understand the value of fresh food, or is that message actually getting out with the First Lady and all the messages that we're hearing?
You know, I think. For a really good answer to that, I think you have to talk more to a sociologist than a lowly food writer.
Don't you feel like a sociologist a little bit, though?
Well, I mean, not in terms of training, but yeah, absolutely. I think in terms of what I do, I mean, I think I write a lot about food and cooking, but really what I feel like I'm doing often is writing about people. So I think, yeah, and thank you for saying that. But in terms of, is that message going, you know, I was watching TV the other day and I saw a commercial for a big grocery chain, a huge grocery chain. And it was all about, you know, this woman saying, like, oh, my grandfather was a farmer. And I remember being a kid and nothing being better than corn from the field. And now it's summer and it's time for corn. And I'm so excited to go to this grocery, you know, this supermarket and buy corn in the summer. And I think that, you know, the idea of only eating corn in the summer or being really excited for corn in the summer, obviously for many, many, many years, was the only thing you could do. But we had gotten away from that. And I think that's becoming more in the mainstream, that idea of waiting for food to come into season. And a chef I know uses a really, really nice phrase called practicing the art of anticipation.
So it's worth the wait until it's actually here and fresh.
Yeah, and that's when it's really good. Like, why eat a pale imitation of a tomato that tastes kind of like a cucumber 10 months out of the year? I mean, it's your call. It's your choice to make.
Frances Lamb writes about food for the online magazine Salon. You can find its work at salon.com/food. Frances, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Yeah, thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.